Coming right up is Women Writing Women's Lives, produced by Judy Feistel, featuring Portland authors Carol Glauber, Sarah Halperin, and Sandy Polishuk. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Hey, here you go. Stay tuned.
Hello. What you're about to hear is a discussion between three of us, three women from Portland. Each of us has written a book about a woman. In one case, a biography. In another case, an oral history. In a third case, something that crosses the boundaries of biography, oral history, and memoir. I'm Sarah Halperin, and I have written the crossover book, Seema's Show, A Life on the Left, which was published just last August, 2005, by University of New Mexico Press. And here with me are Sandy Polishuk, who will introduce herself.
Well, I'm the one who wrote the oral history, and my subject was a Portlander. I'm Sandy Polishuk, and my book is Sticking to the Union, an oral history, the life and times of Julia Rutila.
And I'm Carol Glauber, and I'm the author of Witch of Kodakery, The Photography of Myra Albert Wiggins. And Myra Wiggins was a photographer who was born in Salem, Oregon, and I spent 8 years researching and writing, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that.
And one of the reasons that I, Sarah, found it interesting as we talked together about the books we had written is the commonalities and also the differences among them. In the case of Myra Wiggins, the subject of Carol's book, she was a photographer who really had quite a passion for her work and devoted her life to it. Sandy's subject was a labor activist, Julia Rutila.
Rutila.
And also a writer. Mm-hmm. My subject was a left activist, a member of the Communist Party, and a photographer who didn't really come out with her work as a photographer until she was 95 when she had her first show. But until then, she supported many men in her life, including Ansel Adams and Edward Weston and his son Chan.
I just thought of another kind of connection between Julia and Seema in that Julia, her writing was primarily journalism, though at home she was always writing poems and novels and things like that, and rarely publishing them. But after her retirement, she wasn't 195, whatever it was, when Seema had her first show, but because she didn't live that long. But she self-published a book of her poetry. So that seems to me a little bit analogous to Seema coming out with her first show in her old age after her
Something
retirement.
About not feeling that really it's serious enough that you're entitled to make claim to your own art. I know in Seema's case it had a lot to do with what she called her internalized sexism.
I think in Julia's case it was more financial, that you know you didn't make money, or I mean, she did try to get some of these things published.
Well, that was true with Seema too. She didn't feel she could make a guaranteed living showing her work, whereas as a darkroom technician, she knew she could make a living. So that was also a class thing, working class thing.
What about Myra? Well, it's interesting. Myra was much different. Mm-hmm. She was the master at self-promotion. And she was so enthusiastic about photography and the work that she was doing. And at the time that she was starting to do her work, photography had become very popular in our country. This is in the 1890s. And interestingly enough, many women were taking up photography at the time. And this often surprises people. And many contests and competitions were held around the country because corporations were interested in promoting their products. And so Bausch & Lomb and Kodak, for example, would offer cash prizes and tickets to places around the world to people who would enter the contest and win. And Myra was one of the recipients of many awards and many contests. She won probably the equivalent of about $12,000 in today's money over a period of about 15 or 20 years. And by earning this money, she was reinvested it in her work and enabled her to travel and be fairly independent of her husband. But later in life, she also changed careers, and she took up painting and dropped photography. And I also discuss that in my book. And I think that's common sometimes in women who live a long life. They'll often change careers when the need arises. This was in the midst of the Depression. She was no longer able to earn the kind of money that she was earning doing photography, and she had started out as a painter when she went to the Art Students League in New York City when she was young, and so she returned to that and taught painting, mentored other women, and did what she could to earn a living as a painter and exhibiting her paintings around the country. So she was an artist throughout her life.
That's interesting. It makes me also think that we're three women sitting around the table, and I'll bet people are wondering how each of us got to write our books, how we became engaged with our subjects in the first place. And maybe, Sandy, you could say something about that.
Yeah, I met Julia really shortly after I moved to Portland in the mid-60s. Met her in the anti-Vietnam War movement. But I didn't start writing about her right away. It was actually in the 80s. Julia was on the board of an organization that I was involved in, which made a lot of sense because it was the Northwest Women's History Project, and Julia had lived in Oregon most of the 20th century and was involved in a lot of things and interested in women's history. And after we did our main project, which was an oral history of the women who worked in the shipyards during World War II, we made this show called Good Work Sister. We got together, we had a board retreat, an all-day board and those of us who'd actually produced the show, and we kind of brainstormed what we should do next, and Julia suggested that we should do the Ladies Auxiliary's role in the International Woodworkers of America lockout of 1937. Well, I hadn't even heard of the International Woodworkers of America, let alone the 1937 lockout. And so Tina Tao and I, Tina was another member of the project, we went and interviewed Julia about this as a kind of first step to see if this would be something for the project to do. And we never did anything. You know, most of the people were just getting married and having babies, and project never did anything again beyond
Were you one of those postcards. Women getting married?
No, I already had my children.
You had yours.
I was older than most of them. So we never did another project. But I had known Julia for almost 20 years at this point, and I'd never heard this story. And it was an amazing story of women's strength and importance in the labor movement. But it also made me realize how many stories Julia had that I didn't know. And one of my favorite oral historian lines is, when someone dies, a library burns down. And, or, you know, it's like. And Julia was never healthy from the time I met her. She had arthritis, angina, asthma. She was real. And so I just thought she could, you know, be incapacitated and unable to do this or die at any time. And that's why I started interviewing her. I didn't think about it as a book. I thought about it more in an archival sense, just to get her stories down so they wouldn't be lost. It was a few years later that I started working on the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you met Julia through working together.
Mm-hmm.
I actually met Seema through work that I was doing, and she called me up and left a message on my answering machine. This is 20 years ago now, criticizing a film I had made about aging. I was a filmmaker then, and she had seen this film. She was 80, I was 43. And she called me up and left a message saying she liked my other films, but my film on aging left something to be desired. And she invited me to tea with six of her other older friends to give me a critique of my film. And I was very nervous, but they were really kind. And that was the beginning of a friendship that developed over the years. I actually did interview Seema several times, starting early in our acquaintance, because I was a filmmaker, and at the beginning, her idea was that I should make a better film about aging, mm-hmm. and I dutifully tried to interview people, but my heart wasn't in filmmaking anymore, and I was doing other things then. And it wasn't until I'd known her for, I guess, 15 years, that it occurred to me that it would be interesting to write a book about her life. And she wasn't sure she was important enough for me to do that. But eventually she decided that she'd witnessed a lot of important events. And again, I think you have this idea of a woman who put herself behind the things that she believed in. She would work for them, she would struggle for them, but she couldn't put herself out easily. And that was something that, when she was 95, was a huge breakthrough for her
to actually show
her work, yeah, and speak about it. The book was very similar to that. Putting her life in the center of things was something that took her quite a while to get used to thinking about.
You reminded me of something Julia used to always say to me, which was, I should stop wasting my life, my time, on her misspent life.
Isn't that interesting?
That was her line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, Myra wasn't around to tell me
not
to write about her.
Yeah, you never met
yourself. No, I never met Myra, but I had the good fortune to meet people who did know her. And I think she was definitely not the kind of person who would have been so reticent about showing her work. Yeah. I think she would have been pleased to know that somebody was interested in writing about her and her life and work. And I was interested in doing a project like this for a long time. I have a background in history and education and as a photographer, and I've always had an interest in biography. And so when this came along, I jumped at it. It was something I'd always wanted to do. It worked out well. There were still people around who knew her, including her niece, who was in her 80s when I met her, and we became good friends for quite a few years until she died. And Wiggins' grandson filled me in quite a bit on their relationship, and her friends in Seattle who knew her at the time that she lived there for quite a few years. And so it was good fortune that I was able to interview people who knew her. It really filled in a lot about her personality and the kinds of things that she liked to do and how she related to people.
Now, you did not have the challenge that Sandy and I had of working with living subjects. And I wonder, what were your biggest challenges in writing about Myra?
Well, it's true that Myra was not here, but her family was still here. And so, of course, I gave them the manuscript to read and get their input. And that was important to me. You know, that still presents its own challenges. I think challenges maybe is a bit strong word, but it is different than if you're writing about someone who lived hundreds of years ago and there's no one around to question what you've done or have input. Or
but Carol, you said when Myra came along, you didn't really tell us how you ended up on this project.
That's right. It's serendipity. I was contracted to teach a course on history of women photographers, and I was putting up a poster around town to advertise it, and I took it into Citizens Camera Shop where they have a bulletin board. So I walked in, and as I walked into the store, one of their employees happened to approach me from a back room, and I showed him my poster, and I asked him if I could hang it up on the wall on their bulletin board, and he looked at it and said, "Oh, what do you know about Myra Wiggins?" And I said, "Well, not much, only that she was a member of the Photo Secession." And he said, "Well, I know somebody who knows all about her." And he gave me this young man's name and phone number, and I called him up, and it turned out that he was a friend of the family. And he came to my house one day and talked to me, and that's really how it started.
Hooked you.
Yes. I took one look. He had some copies of her work, and I took one look at it, and it was so interesting to me. And the time period is a time that I relate to. I really enjoy learning about the time period where she was living and working, and it's a local subject. And that's really how it took off.
In case you've just tuned in, this is Sarah Halprin, Sandy Polishuk, and Carol Glauber. We're three Portland writers speaking about the books we've written. Carol wrote a book about Myra Wiggins, a photographer of the photo secession. Sandy Polishuk wrote a book called Sticking to the Union about Julia, you'll pronounce Rutula. It better, Rutula. And that she was a labor activist and writer. I'm Sarah Halprin, and I wrote a book called Seema's Show about Seema Weatherwax, who was a left activist and photographer. Sandy, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that you faced in writing the oral history of Julia.
Well, in addition, of course, I wasn't a writer when I started, so I had to learn how to write. I had originally the naive idea that because Julia told a great story, all I had to do was record it and transcribe it. And so I was fairly quickly abused of that idea. but the real challenge in terms of the content of the book was that Julia, well, whenever you're doing an oral history, you have to deal with the imperfections of memory. But Julia in particular was a well-known exaggerator. And then it turned out, and this unfortunately really didn't come out till after she had died. She died in 91, and my book didn't come out until 2003. I'm kind of slow and easily distracted. But after she died, I really started discovering some of the discrepancies between her stories and other people's stories and the record, the written record. And when other people's stories and the written record agreed, then I knew for sure that Julia was telling me something that wasn't quite true. But it was interesting. At that point, I already had a book contract, and when I told my editor some of the more serious things, like Julia had always said that her paternal grandmother was black and a former slave. And when that story fell apart, I thought, oh my God, am I going to lose this book contract? And my editor, fortunately, just said, oh no, this just makes it more interesting. Mm-hmm. So it did become that intersection between, I don't just see it as, I mean, it's not memory. Julia didn't forget who her grandmother was. Mm-hmm. It's kind of this creation of persona. And, you know, so the why did she do this kind of became, an important part of who she was for me. So it was challenging, but it was also kind of fun, trying to figure out, what the reality is. But I think that any biographer is going to come up against that. I mean, you know, if you compare a biography of somebody with their memoir, you'll find those same discrepancies, I think. So I don't think Julia was so unusual.
Well, but what you're saying really raises what interests me, because I did write across different genres. And one of the big differences between a biography and a memoir is that a biographer is accountable, as a historian is, for getting the facts straight. And a memoirist is considered, especially these days, memoir is considered much closer to what's called creative nonfiction. There's a lot of leeway. And here I was, not writing a biography per se, not writing an oral history as you did, although my work is mainly based on interviews, but I was working with a living subject, and my interaction with that living subject, who had a lot of opinions about what I should and should not say about her, was my big challenge in writing the book. And that's where, for me, memoir came into play, because there was a point of subjective decision where I made decisions about to what extent I respected Seema's wishes, and in the sense of honoring confidentiality, I did respect her, but also to what extent I felt I needed to write a book that was readable and accessible to a lot of people. And in accounting for that, I turned to the tools of memoir. as well as the tools of the biographer and the oral historian.
Well, do you think sometimes that you really were just like, not just, but helping her write her memoir?
No, she actually had that opinion, but it wouldn't have been very good. And that was where I had to assert myself in a way that was challenging. We were good friends, and I understood her concerns. I also had material that she had confided to me as a friend that she didn't want included in the book. And so it was really a delicate negotiation about what I could convince her really belonged there in terms of making the book interesting and readable, what I had to respect could be left out because she really cared not to have a certain name named or whatever that detail was. And there were places where it just really was difficult. She did not want me to mention her membership in the Communist Party. And because she'd been in it for almost 70 years, I couldn't leave it out. There was just no way I could write a responsible account of her life, or a truthful one in any way. So that was complicated, and that was a challenge for me.
One of the things oral historians mm-hmm. run into all the time is people saying, turn off that tape recorder and I'll tell you something. And, you know, and so you're in this kind of, you know it, just like you did, and yet you're in a kind of moral dilemma if you really want to use it.
Right. And I guess in my case, I've also had the tremendous privilege of having my subject live long enough to read the book or have it read to her since she's blind now and approve it and get good feedback on it from her friends, which is a tremendous delight to me and sort of made the whole thing worthwhile in many ways. It could have gone otherwise.
What kind of memoir technique did you use?
Well, I used memoir when I was describing the interactions between Seema and me, which is not an issue that came up for you as a biographer, Carol. And I think, Sandy, you dealt with it differently in your book.
I have a prologue. I mean,
right.
An afterword.
You describe...
I have an afterword that's a memoir piece.
Yes. And mm-hmm. to be clear about what that is, in creating memoir, I was creating scenes that took place between Seema and me and using my creative liberties to construct details in those scenes that happened 15 or 20 years ago. So I don't remember exactly the conversation as it would have been had I been able to record it. I didn't have a tape recorder. It was the first time I'd met her, for example. And I created that scene and put in lines of dialogue. This is the privilege of the memoirist. But it wouldn't have belonged in a biography, a straightforward biography. So, in that sense, I happily trod across boundaries all the time.
But see, in oral history, your subject will do that. Julie told me stories and put conversations in them, and, you know, it's kind of the same.
Except when then you're trying to track it.
I'm not the one. Julia.
She did it, and you're trying to figure out how close that was to anything else. I mean, in my case, I had interviews with Seema's sister, who lived until 2 years ago. She died at 97. She had different versions of accounts in their joint past. And she said to me at one point, you know, if my story and Seema's are different, you should take Seema's, because it's her book you're writing. Which was very touching, but there were cases where I had a sort of historian's conscience, and I would look for a third source to see if I could get some kind of sense of which of them was closer, or just include both.
Well, I mean, that was certainly my experience. I interviewed 50 people.
Right.
And especially with her friends, they would tell me, there was this one friend that told me how she introduced her to her husband, and Julia told me a completely different story. And again, I had a third source who told me a story that made the other friend's story unlikely. But I still was never, you know, you just never know, you know, it's life. You don't know about the past.
That was Sandy Polishuk talking about Julia Rutila. And Carol, I wonder if you had any issues in writing Myra Wiggins' biography where you had to make decisions about what was closer to the reality you wanted to portray in your book.
Not really, not in the same sense that you've been discussing here, because I think, as you brought up, writing biography is a different sort of genre than you're discussing with your cross between oral history and memoir. And I did quite a bit of research and had to layer all of that together to create a story. For example, I traveled to all the places that Myra ever lived or spend any time. For instance, she was born in Salem, so I went down to Salem to look for where her husband's business was and where her house would have been. I went to Yakima when she moved there and actually got a tour of the house that they built in Toppenish, and I went to Seattle and saw where she lived there on Capitol Hill. I went to Neskowin to see where she went to the beach. And in fact, we go to Neskowin all the time now because of that. Mm-hmm. And really getting to know her as intimately as I could, even by the geography of things that impacted her.
And I know that Sandy and I also did similar things. Sandy, you went to all the places Julia lived.
Yeah, the best one was when Julia, when she lived in Astoria, she and her husband built a house and Julia designed it.
Wow.
And one day I went and knocked on the door of this house, and when the woman invited me in, and we had quite a conversation. This is probably at least 10 years ago. And just a month ago, I had a Chautauqua appearance in Astoria, and that woman came.
Oh, my goodness.
And she told everybody else about this experience of having me come knock on her door. I also found the farm that Julia's family lived on during World War One. That was really interesting, outside Eugene. And, of course, the area's really changed, and there's like three or four farms on what had been their land now. But the general geography, I don't know, there's something about standing there, I think it's sort of like the feeling I had when I went to the Lewis and Clark exhibit and looked at these things and thought, Lewis and Clark actually touched that item. You know,
right.
When you're in this place where your person lived, and she had a story about being, you know, how their house was on a hill, and so I could walk up the hill and look down
exactly.
And think, I'm seeing what she saw. Yeah, there's something about almost becoming the person you're writing about.
I had the same experience when I was able to visit places Seema had lived in. She lived in Los Angeles for many years, and I tracked down, I think all of the houses she lived in. Of course, Los Angeles has changed immensely since the 20s when she first went there. But still, walking those streets did have that feeling. I would have loved to go to Tahiti, where she lived for a year, and to Russia, where she was born. But I didn't have the funding to make that kind of trip possible.
Now, Myra Wiggins, in 1907, moved from Salem to Toppenish, which is near Yakima, Washington, and because her husband decided that he wanted to enter the nursery business. Well, this must have been a very radical move for her, because she had to leave behind all of her family and her friends and the mountains and the climate and everything that she'd known all of her life, and moved to an area that was dry, sparsely populated, no electricity, and very isolated. And I was curious how she got there. And so I went to the Historical Society and looked at their, asked to see their maps from that time, and learned that there were no roads from Portland to Yakima, and that the only way she was able to get there was by train.
And, of course, there was a much better train system many years ago than there is now. Seema used to commute from Los Angeles to Long Beach by the red train. And we had those kinds of trains in the Portland area. And they went to Eugene, to the coast. This is a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, but I think we would do well to go back to those days.
I think we would enjoy that.
Yeah.
Well, we could go on for hours. I know we haven't even touched on how we got ourselves published, and because we all had good publishers, and how books get marketed and all of that.
And edited.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a
yes.
huge process.
And we haven't talked about the use of photographs in our books.
That's
which
right.
Yeah,
which we all
Carol
did. I mean,
and you
too. You more than I, but yeah. But that's for another time. I thank you so much for getting together with me to talk about this. It's really fun talking
thank
to you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Sharing our common experience.
It's really interesting. And I'm just grateful also to the women who inspired us so that we wouldn't be here if it weren't for Myra and Seema and Julia.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful to their spirits.
I know that you don't know this yet because Seema's still alive, but I think, Carol, you probably agree with me on this. There's this one way that I feel like I've helped Julia live on, that most people kind of disappear once everyone who knew them is gone. And when you've made a book about somebody, you've really extended the consciousness of their life, and it almost feels like their life. And that feels very like an honor.
It is an honor.
And in my case, I know that it's given Seema a new lease on life at the age of 100 to have this book out about her.
Yeah.
So thanks, everybody. And thank you, Judy Fiesel, who's been recording our talk together here at KABU. You've been listening to a discussion by Sandy Polishuk, Carol Glauber, and Sarah Halperin of Portland, Oregon, about our three books. Sandy's book is Sticking to the Union, A Life of Julia Rutila. Carol's book is Myra Wiggins, The Witch of Kodakery. My book is Seema Show, A Life on the Left.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. This is International Women's Day, and there's lots going on down here at KABU. Lots of food, lots of fun, lots of women. And now here's one of my favorite women, Laurie Anderson.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to London, Laurie Anderson.